to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is GSUGGSinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated October 13, 2025. Its front cover is bordered in red as usual with a narrow white inner border. Time, in large block capital letters, is in white, superimposed against a pale beige or gray or both background. The Boss is inscribed on the cover by Eric Cortellesa. That will be the lead article today. It is a photographic image of Bruce Springsteen, gray hair combed back from his face, brown eyes looking at the camera. I'm going to count three gold hoops in his left ear, wearing a black jacket, blue jeans, a black and white striped vest, a gray shirt, and a black tie. The Art of Being the Boss, by Eric Cortellesa, Asbury Park, New Jersey. No one notices Bruce Springsteen. This is under the heading Culture. He makes no effort to hide. Black t-shirt, blue jeans, Wayfarer sunglasses, honky-tonk cowboy boots, but for a few minutes, the most famous son of the Jersey Shore achieves a kind of anonymity, even in the one place his sudden appearance seems most plausible, the Asbury Park boardwalk. Passing Madame Maurice, the fortune teller, immortalized in his 1973 ballad, 4th of July, Asbury Park, Sandy, I suggest if people look for him anywhere, it's here, Springsteen chuckles, recalling a t-shirt sold in local shops. I heard Bruce might show up. Soon we discover what happens when he does. Near the convention hall, a double take becomes a selfie request. More follow. A restaurant owner begs him to stay for dinner. Outside the Bruce Springsteen Archives store, a cashier leaps up in delight, serendipitously wearing the very shirt we had just been discussing. My cloak of invisibility is rapidly fading, Springsteen says, half amused, half resigned. We find refuge in an empty stone pony, the fabled club that launched his career, where we spent the afternoon talking about his life and legacy. As for the crowd he slips into a car to leave behind, he says, I always took it as just part of the job. For a half century, Springsteen's job has been unlike any other. He's released 21 albums, collecting 20 Grammys, an Oscar, a Tony, the Kennedy Center Honors, and the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He has written a best-selling memoir, recorded a podcast with Barack Obama, and sold more than 150 million records worldwide. He is one of the most in-demand live performers on earth, commanding crowds who embrace him with something close to religious devotion. His most recent tour grossed more than $700 million, the largest haul of his career, eclipsing the Born in the USA juggernaut of the 80s. But the story of Springsteen is more than the scale of his success. He occupies a rarefied place in American life, maintaining an authenticity rare for a performer of his reach, even as he grapples with the contradictions of his existence. Springsteen is a tribune for the working class who became fabulously rich, a reckless outsider who is a rooted family man, and the rock star who has seemingly everything but still wrestles with shadows he cannot shake. As the stages grew larger, from clubs to theaters, arenas to stadiums, Springsteen chose not to disguise the distance between the man on stage and the man in the mirror, but to make it part of the art itself. Now Springsteen, 76, has undertaken another daring move, surrendering control to a team of filmmakers to tell the story of the most vulnerable period of his life. Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere, in theaters October 24, chronicles the making of Nebraska, his 1982 acoustic masterpiece. Jeremy Allen White plays Springsteen. Jeremy Strong portrays his longtime manager, John Landau. The film captures a sliver of his early 30s, when he was battling his first bout of serious depression, compulsively driving past his childhood home, and eventually seeking therapy, a step Springsteen credits with saving his life. "It could have gone in a lot of different directions," he says. That crucible altered the trajectory of his career, sharpening the themes that have fueled his music since, a starker portrait of America, an insistence on dignity for the marginalized, redemption for the broken, the possibility of salvation in community, while allowing him to remain both uncompromising and commercially viable. Just as significant, it led him to embrace family life, the responsibilities and joys so often elusive for rock stars. "The show business life is wonderful if it's part of a larger life," says Landau, his closest confidant. "If it becomes a substitute for life, that's the danger zone." After the Boardwalk, Springsteen returns to his home studio in Colts Neck, a 10-minute drive from where he grew up. 50 years after Born to Run, he may be associated with getting out, but his life has been defined by sticking around. "What I worked very hard on was not running, but on standing, on making your life choices, then standing with and for them," he says. "That's been my theme since that record." If the heroes of Born to Run found their glory in flight, Springsteen has since offered the countervision that to stay put, to face your own demons head-on, is its own form of heroism. On a gray October afternoon in 2023, Springsteen opened the door of a rented Jersey Shore cottage and ushered three men inside to discuss something he had long resisted, a film about his life. Springsteen had invited Scott Cooper, director of brooding films such as Crazy Heart and Out of the Furnace, Warren Zanes, author of the definitive book on Nebraska, Landau, serving what he claimed were Philly cheesesteaks. "These were not cheesesteaks," Zanes remembers. "This was really good steak on artisanal bread with exquisite cheese." From the outset, Springsteen was drawn to Cooper's vision, not a cradle-to-the-grave biopic, but a compact character study. This narrow time frame reveals deeper truths about Bruce's lifelong struggles with identity and creative honesty, Cooper says. "Hardly anyone expected Springsteen to say yes, but with age," Springsteen says, "he's become more willing to agree to proposals he once dismissed. I'm old. I don't give a F space CK what I do anymore," he says with a grin. "As you get older, you feel a lot freer." Springsteen recounts the process in A Dimly Lit Stone Pony. He became a fixture here just before his 1975 breakout, Born to Run, when he was on a three-record deal with Columbia. His first two albums in 1973 were praised by critics, but they disappointed commercially, and the label shifted its attention to Billy Joel. At risk of being cast aside, Springsteen shed the rhyme-drunk ballads of his earlier work. He barely had a driver's license, but understood what cars represented to a country rattled by the oil embargo. Gas prices had soared, and an ordinary symbol of American freedom suddenly felt precarious. If gas was too expensive, you could not drive. If you could not drive, you lost your agency. I didn't know a lot about cars, he says, but I knew what they meant. It was simply my metaphor. Born to Run fused the street-level detail of Dylan with the operatic grandeur of Phil Spector. Its opening track, Thunder Road, is a summons. The singer beckons Mary into his car, a chance to flee a town full of losers for a better life. Jungle Land, the 9-minute finale, stages the saga of the magic rat and the barefoot girl who slip across Jersey into Harlem only to see their dreams collapse. Critics hailed Born to Run as a crowning achievement, something both sui generis and revitalizing. The counterculture had curdled, Vietnam was over but unsettled, and the economy sagged into stagflation. Into that drift came a wiry kid from Freehold, New Jersey, who made the ordinary seem mythic. It was a magical group of things and circumstances that helped deliver this guy and deliver Columbia's dream, says Springsteen's first manager, Mike Apple. October 20, 1975. Springsteen appeared on the covers of Time and Newsweek, a feat once reserved for presidents, popes, or astronauts. For Springsteen, holed up at the Sunset Marquee for a four-night stand at the Roxy, it felt like a curse. It's making you very, very different than all the people you grew up with, he says. Success was both exhilarating and terrifying. His sister Pam recalls paparazzi peering into their parents' kitchen. Springsteen and his circle worried about the hype, a toxic word that suggested the deflators were not far behind. What haunted him even more was how fame might change him. It is a very distorted lens to live your life through, he says. You have to be very protective of yourself, of what matters dearly to you. With 1978's Darkness on the Edge of Town, Springsteen planted his feet with those who never made it out, using his songs to speak to someone he could not otherwise reach. He turned toward the working class, sketching figures who resembled his father, the stoic men of factory, the dreamers of racing in the street. Douglas Springsteen was taciturn, drifting through jobs he could never keep, cab driver, prison guard, and prone to rages and long silences, staying up late with beer and cigarettes. He was emotionally absent from his three children, Bruce, Virginia, and Pam, and especially hard on his son, who says his father never once said he loved him. The family's mediator and breadwinner, the one who carried its optimism and kept it afloat, was Bruce's mother, Adele, who worked as a legal secretary. Bruce says now that his bleak songs came from his father, whereas his joyous ones, Rosalita, Out in the Street, came from his mother. For a working-class man in the 1950s, seeking psychiatric care meant defying social mores. Only decades later was Doug Springsteen diagnosed as bipolar and schizophrenic, enabling him to get the help he needed. But Bruce would always fear that the strain of mental illness running through his family might one day ensnare him. Sp- Springsteen's next record, The River, veered toward connection. For a long time, I did not write any love songs, he said. I figured other people were taking care of it. I was interested in other topics, and I simply did not know what it was. The album produced his first Billboard Top 10 single, Hungry Heart, and the verdict at Columbia was clear. Springsteen was on the brink of superstardom. This is where the film Deliver Me From Nowhere begins. After the River tour, Springsteen plunged into psychic freefall. Instead of chasing hits, he retreated to a house in Colts Neck with a four-track recorder. What emerged was Nebraska, a desolate gallery of outlaws, killers, and lost souls. After Springsteen laid several tracks for what would become 1984's Born in the USA, which everyone knew was lightning in a bottle, he took a break to record demos on a cassette with the plan of recreating them in the studio with the E Street Band. But the more they re-recorded them, the more Springsteen hated it, so he decided to release the tapes as they were. When Nebraska came out, September 30, 1982, Springsteen let the music speak for itself. No interviews, no tour. He then took a road trip out west and had a breakdown, but in therapy found reconciliation with both his past and with his father, played in the film by Stephen Graham. My father was a tough guy, Springsteen says. He was tough when he was young. He was tough on me when I was young. But fundamentally, underneath, he was a vulnerable, fragile, sweethearted, soulful man. I think you see that part of him at the end of the film. When the movie debuted at Telluride Film Festival, the reviews were glowing. Already, the film is generating Oscar buzz. To play the role, White spent hours studying Springsteen, listening to his memoir on tape, watching old interviews, but knew to avoid imitation. He does not adopt Springsteen's twang, but embodies him psychologically. They first met at a sound check in London's Wembley Stadium last year and cultivated a friendship. White says he made a pact with Springsteen, Landau, and Cooper. Let's make a movie about a musician during this period in his life that just so happens to be Bruce Springsteen. If anyone saw Springsteen clearly in this period, it was Landau, portrayed in the film with uncanny precision by Strong. When he phoned Tom Zimmy, Springsteen's longtime filmmaker, to request archival footage, Strong was still in character, Zimney tells me, method to the core. Their relationship forms the film's emotional spine, elevating it into a love story. After Nebraska's release, Springsteen considered suicide. Landau told him plainly, "You need professional help." The next day, the manager got the star into a therapist's office. It was and has been a total life changer, Springsteen says. After his therapist of 25 years died, Springsteen kept going. When I walked into a new therapist's office, he says, I had a lot more information than when I first walked into Dr. Myers and said, I don't have a home. I don't have a partner. I don't have a life beyond my work. And those are things I want. The film also portrays a dalliance between Springsteen and Odessa Young's Faye, a composite of several relationships meant to capture his fleeting romances as he began to crave commitment. It might have been my own biological clock, he tells me. I was in my early 30s and you start thinking about, hey, where is my everything? On the Born in the USA tour, Springsteen invited singer and guitarist Patti Cialfa to join the E Street Band. It was 1984, and the album ruled the charts. Its singles dominated MTV, and he would soon marry actor Julianne Phillips. But Cialfa's arrival shifted everything. They had met early, excuse me, they had met nearly a decade earlier at the Stone Pony, and Springsteen remembers the exact spot. In fact, we are sitting in it. I met Patty right in this chair, he says, recalling the moment with clarity. Siafa, stepping down from the stage, her voice still ringing in the room. I went, who is that gorgeous redhead singing like Ronnie Spector or Dusty Springfield, he says. Springsteen introduced himself, and the rest, he says, with a smile, has been the rest. Toward the end of the decade, his marriage to Phillips ended, his partnership with Siafa blossomed, and his music veered inward. Tunnel of Love, released in 1987, explored intimacy and the fragility of relationships. Walk Like a Man, among his most piercing songs, begins with a child tracing his father's footsteps in the sand and ends with a groom at the altar, weighing which parts of his old man's heritage to carry forward and which to leave behind. In 1991, he married Siafa. I knew she saw me for who I really was, he says, a complicated, messy person. I did not have to pretend. I was broken, she was broken in her own way, and we were each other's personal projects. On the eve of their first child's birth, Springsteen's father drove hours to see him in Los Angeles. Over 11 a.m. beers, Doug told him. You've been very good to us, and I was not very good to you. The frank admission was his greatest gift to me, Bruce says. He had the fortitude and the wherewithal and the deep understanding that I was about to become a father, and he did not want me to make the same mistakes. Soon after, Bruce wrote Living Proof, a song about the astonishment of becoming a parent, a declaration of transformation and renewal. Two more children followed. All three, now grown, are near the age he was when he made Nebraska. Excuse me, the age he was when he made Nebraska. Fatherhood ended Springsteen's days of running. Two of the best days of my life, he once told Rolling Stone, were the day I picked up the guitar and the day I learned to put it down. When I remind him, he smiles. That's good. I'll stand by that. The guitar, he explains, was his first form of self-medication. It was the only way I knew how to handle my problems, and it was the instrument I went to when I felt myself in a lot of psychological or personal difficulties. But to lean on it for everything, he says, is an abuse of the work, an abuse of the instrument. Music could carry him through the ecstasy of live performance, but beyond that, you've got to find a bigger life, he says. The day you pick it up, that's the 3 hours on stage. The day you put it down, that's the other 21. Before stepping onto a Manchester, England stage, May 14, Springsteen gathered the band for their usual ritual. But instead of his familiar pep talk, he offered a warning. Might get a little heavy tonight, he said. We'll see. Minutes later, he delivered a searing monologue that ricocheted across the world. In my home, the America I love, the America I have written about that has been a beacon of hope and liberty for 250 years, is currently in the hands of a corrupt, incompetent, treasonous administration, he said. Only two people knew in advance, Landau, who saw the speech and told him to change not a word, and the teleprompter operator. He mentioned he was going to do a monologue, recalls saxophonist Jake Clemens, his bandmate and nephew of the late Clarence Clemens, Springsteen's beloved original saxophonist. We did not know what it was till we were on stage. For the European tour, Springsteen revised his set list, swapping Meditations on Morality Mortality from his 2020 album Letter to You for fierce political resistance, beginning with Land of Hope and Dreams, his gospel-infused anthem of inclusion and redemption, and closing with Dylan's Chimes of Freedom, a hymn of solidarity with the oppressed. He just got pissed off enough to want to change the theme, longtime E Street guitarist Stephen Van Zandt says. It was a few months into Donald Trump's norm-shattering second term, and Springsteen was among the first artists of his stature to speak out so forcefully. If I'm going to stay true to who I've tried to be, he tells me, I can't give these guys a free pass. Politics had long shadowed him to his fury. Born in the USA, a protest against the neglect of Vietnam veterans, was hijacked by Ronald Reagan and recast as a flag-saluting celebration. To understand that song, he says, you've got to hold two contradictory thoughts at once, that you can feel betrayed by your country and still love it. Over the years, he has returned to political and social themes, from the AIDS epidemic and the plight of migrant workers to deindustrialization and the ravages of war. Critics have mocked the irony of a rock star traveling by private jet while singing about the working poor. He owns the contradiction, a rich man in a poor man's shirt, as he writes in Better Days. Today the joke's old, but something else haunts him. The very people he sings about have flocked to Trump. A lot of people bought into his lies, he says. He does not care about the forgotten anybody but himself and the multi-billionaires who stood behind him on Inauguration Day. Springsteen struggles with another truth. You have to face the fact that a good number of Americans are simply comfortable with his politics of power and dominance. After Springsteen's speech, Trump called him highly overrated and posted a meme depicting himself striking the rocker with a golf ball. When I bring this up, Springsteen laughs. I absolutely could not care less what he thinks about me. What he does not laugh about is the state of the nation. He's the living personification of what the 25th Amendment and impeachment were for. If Congress had any guts, he'd be consigned to the trash heap of history. Nor does he spare Democrats. We are desperately in need of an effective alternative party, or for the Democratic Party to find someone who can speak to the majority of the nation. There is a problem with the language they're using and the way they're trying to reach people. Springsteen has spent decades exploring the gulf between the American dream and the American reality, the widening economic divides that would power Trump's rise, from the hollowing out of Rust Belt cities, conjured in his 1984 song My Hometown, to the populist rage of his 2012 album about the Great Recession, Wrecking Ball. Those conditions are ripe for a demagogue, he says. Those things have got to be addressed if we want to live in the America of our better angels. I still believe it's there, but it's struggling. During that brief stretch on the boardwalk when we elude recognition, Springsteen steers me toward the spot on the beach where he and the E Street Band performed a year earlier. One of our top five shows of all time for me, he says of the sea. Here, now, festival. The waves crashed behind the stage as fans, including myself, stood barefoot in the sand. Springsteen crafted a unique set list, reaching back for early, deep cuts from when he was still finding his voice, blinded by the light, thunder crack. The climax struck when he performed Born to Run's final two songs, Meeting Across the River, into Jungle Land. The moment snuck up on Springsteen. I did not realize how symbolic it was going to be for me, he says. The town over the past 10 to 15 years returned from the dead. We were here when it was empty and barren. Here was proof of resurrection, a city revived, a community of fans built over half a century, the arc from isolation to communion, the inverse of the spiritual solitude in which Nebraska was born. When I ask whether he will tour with the East Street Band again, he doesn't hesitate. Of course. A solo tour is also a possibility, but nothing's planned. I just want to keep going, he tells me. I want to make records that deal with subjects people have not heard me deal with yet. In the meantime, he offers other treasures. For years, he had denied the existence of Electric Nebraska. Full band versions of the songs he first cut on cassette in 1982. But one day, curiosity got the better of him, and he found the tapes in his archives. The sessions will be released this fall, timed with the new film. Tracks 3, another collection of unreleased material, is slated for 2 or 3 years from now. Springsteen keeps the details close, but lets one out. It will include his famously slow, hypnotic cover of Bob Dylan's I Want You. Today his days follow a simple rhythm: wake up, work out, head to the studio, spend the evenings with Sialfa, who has been battling blood cancer since 2018. Reading, watching TV, listening to music. He just finished Moby Dick, and the young artists he admires are Zach Bryan and Boy Genius. New music of his own is on the way to continue a conversation with his fans, he says. Each album must represent something new. The first thing that really reaches the public is the thing they tend to hold on to and want you to hold on to. He explains, what the writer has to do is you write yourself into a box, and then you are Houdini. You continue your work until you feel yourself locked in that bigger box, and then you're supposed to escape into a bigger box. He remembers the mid-70s playing to a small crowd in a dingy New York City club after the sensation of Born to Run. A friend, baffled, asks, what are you doing here? Springsteen had an answer in his mind. I was just building my little house, a block at a time, he says. I was not out of the basement yet, but I knew I wanted a career that would live and grow with my audience. To Springsteen, the Asbury Park concert was the culmination of that long construction project. I feel that the band kept faith with its audience, worked hard to be at its best, never went on stage without playing like it was the last night on earth. But those are the 3 hours. The other 21 remain his life's work. At a show in the 1990s, Springsteen performed My Father's House, a harrowing song from Nebraska. The narrator dreams of embracing his estranged father, only to wake, drive to the old home, and find a stranger at the door. His father has vanished. Their sins lie unatoned. The hope of reconciliation lost. On stage, Springsteen framed it with a story from therapy. He confessed to his habit of circling his childhood home. Something bad happened, Dr. Myers told him. You're going back, thinking you can make it right again. That is what I'm doing, Springsteen replied. Well, Dr. Myers said, you can't. When I ask how he absorbed the insight, how he put it into practice, Springsteen pauses. Well, I don't know, he says. I still drive by that house. I read longer than typically is done with one article, The Art of Being the Boss by Eric Cortalesa, Asbury Park, New Jersey. War Games, this is from the World heading, How Ukraine Turned Drone Combat into a Competition by Simon Schuster, Kyiv. One afternoon this spring, Mykhailo Fedorov, a minister in the wartime government of Ukraine, turned up the volume on his laptop and played a video to illustrate his latest innovation. Its purpose, he explained, was to make the experience of combat feel more like a video game to Ukrainian troops, or as he put it, to gamify the war. The clip showed a series of aerial strikes, each filmed from the vantage of a combat drone. One of them, apparently flying by night, had used its thermal imaging camera to detect an enemy soldier in what looked like a field or forest. It was difficult to tell because the background was dark and the figure in the frame resembled a white blob more than a human being. The Russian soldier seemed to freeze in place as the drone hovered. Then it dropped its explosive charge, and a shower of sparks burst outward from the spot where the man had been. That's 6 points, Fedorov told me. It used to be only four. A few weeks earlier, Fedorov had tweaked the algorithm he controls to increase the number of points the Ukrainian military's drone units receive for killing a Russian soldier. The result of the change, he said, had been astonishing. The kill count doubled in a month. At 34, Fedorov is one of the youngest members of President Volodymyr Zelensky's War Council, a square-jawed fitness enthusiast who likes to wear a black baseball cap over his crew cut. His office in central Kyiv feels as if it might be a frat house at MIT, with free weights and other workout gear surrounding the minister's desk. On the day I visited, small drones stood on the shelves in various stages of assembly, their colorful wires and circuit boards exposed. Over the past 3.5 years of war, drones have done more than any other weapons to help Ukraine defend itself. They now account for about 2/3 of battlefield deaths in a war of attrition that has, by U.S. estimates, killed or wounded hundreds of thousands of troops. Ukraine has deployed drones by the millions, turning what began as a battle of tanks and artillery into a high-tech proving ground for the world's deadliest gadgets. Fedorov, the country's minister of digital transformation, has played a key role in shaping the strategy. His latest scheme, known as the Army of Drones Bonus Program, brings elements of Roblox and Fortnite to both the blood-soaked realm of real-life combat and the arid one of weapons acquisition. The program established a system for Ukrainian drone units to document their strikes. Each confirmed kill receives a set of bonus points corresponding to the value that Fedorov, in consultation with the military brass, assigns the targets. Around the time we met, destroying a Russian tank was worth 40 points. A multiple rocket launcher was up to 50 points, depending on the type. At the end of each month, an official review board of experts and officers verifies each strike, tallies the points, and releases a list of the best-scoring teams. The points can be redeemed to order more advanced drones on a digital marketplace known as Brave One, the numeral one, which Fedorov's ministry oversees. Many of Brave One's offerings are classified, but the public part of the platform lists hundreds of items for sale. Among the most popular is the Vampire Drone, a heavy bomber with 6 rotors, which can be redeemed for 43 points. Fedorov says logistics teams take about 10 days on average to deliver the purchased items, which the drone units use to carry out more strikes and amass more points. Beyond its use as a motivational tool, the Army of Drones program allows the high command in Kyiv to adjust the targets their forces prioritize. If Ukraine needs to wear down the number of Russian artillery pieces, for instance, Fedorov can increase the number of points granted for destroying them. In a war of technologies, he told me, nothing is more valuable than a clear understanding of what gear is going to get you the best results. Now we see it in real time. What's working? What's not? The Pentagon has taken notice. At the U.S. base in Wiesbaden, Germany, senior military officers have observed the program and drawn lessons from its success, one of them told me. It can take years, this U.S. official says, for the Army to order, receive, and deploy new weapons through the Defense Department's system of procurement. Our process is bigger and more cumbersome, more legalistic, says the officer, who asked not to be identified in keeping with military protocol. The Ukrainians, says the U.S. official, found a way to shrink that timeline down to a week, using a military version of Amazon Prime, where commanders at the front can order what they need directly from arms manufacturers. That's something we look at and say, wow, could we do that? Ukraine's gamification of war may be the natural terminus of a tech culture that gamifies everything. Apps have learned that designing their interfaces this way increases user engagement, whether the purpose is learning a language or training for a marathon or getting better at chess. So in a sense, it is no surprise that Fedorov, the digital minister, would introduce a program like this in a country whose very existence now hinges on the ability to integrate cutting-edge tech into war. But running lethal combat into a competition creates moral challenges on an entirely new scale, and solving them does not seem high on Ukraine's present list of priorities. I first heard about the bonus program about a year ago when the founder of a Ukrainian drone unit joined me for lunch in Kiev's trendy district of Podil. Once the waiter had set two bowls of borscht on our table, my companion looked around the restaurant with an air of conspiracy and handed me his phone. "Check this out," he said. The screen showed the first monthly ranking in the bonus program, with his group in the top 10. "Think of it as an antidote to Bull SH space T," he told me. "By verifying strikes through video footage, it prevents units from falsifying their numbers in reports to the high command. It also serves as a type of stimulus," said the founder, who asked me not to identify him or the name of his unit for security reasons. "When other stimuli are running out, when people are getting tired, they find it hard to keep going on patriotism alone, so this gives them an extra push, an extra incentive." The Russians, faced with similar problems of flagging morale, have come up with a cruder response. Cash payments are handed out to Russian soldiers for their successes on the battlefield, with a destroyed tank or a conquered village, potentially earning them thousands of dollars, according to Russian media reports and official statements. Battlefield injuries, like severed limbs, are likewise rewarded with sums that most soldiers could not earn in regular jobs. Ukraine cannot afford that strategy. Its defense spending already amounts to more than 30% of its GDP. Higher than any other nation in the world, according to the Budget Committee of the Ukrainian Parliament. It has barely enough money to pay military salaries, let alone dole out bonuses. But in the summer of 2023, when Fedorov first suggested his system of gamification, top military brass rejected the concept. The idea seemed insane to them, he says. Nearly a year passed before Fedorov got his chance to present the proposal at a meeting of Zelensky's War Council. The president listened to the pitch, nodded his head, gave an order to the generals in the room, "Make it happen." In August 2024, when the bonus program began, some of the top drone units in Ukraine refused to participate. Among the holdouts was Lazar's group, a secret outfit whose commander, a former TV news producer named Pavlo Lazar Yelizarov, saw gamification as a symptom of inertia in the high command. In a professional army, there should be internal mechanisms for assessing the quality of strikes, motivating forces, and deciding who gets more drones, Yelizarov told me. Instead, Ukraine has relied on a game designed by civilians to rank and reward its best commanders. Yelizarov admits the game has made Ukraine's drone warfare more efficient, but it has also come with risks, he says. It concentrates all this sensitive data in one document, and it can fall into the wrong hands. Over the course of the program, such concerns have been validated. At first, the list of top-scoring teams would leak to the media at the end of every month. Later, it began appearing on the Brave One website, allowing the winners to advertise their lethality. Yelizarov saw such publicity as dangerous. It reveals the leading figures among our drone units, he says, and that helps the Russians set priorities for whom to target. But in the view of most drone commanders, the value of the program outweighs these risks. Many of the Ukraine's military units rely on private fundraising to help supply the equipment they need. Fedorov's Army of Drones program provided a form of free advertising, and few could resist the temptation to exploit it. Some of the drone commanders styled themselves as warrior celebrities, appearing on talk shows and printing hats and T-shirts with their unit's logos. Even Lazar's group came around. After joining at the end of last year, it became a fixture of the leaderboard. Yelizarov's name soon leaked to the media. In August, he agreed to appear on the cover of the Ukrainian edition of Forbes, which reported his unit had destroyed Russian targets worth a total of $12 billion. Lazar's group has changed the rules of battle, trumpeted its latest promotional video, which Yelizarov sent me in September. We showed the way that units of the future work. Last fall, when the Army of Drones game was in its second month, one of Ukraine's leading drone units invited me to take a tour of their headquarters. At the time, its staff of several hundred men included dozens of strike teams, each with a drone pilot, a navigator, and several crew members. The pilots tended to operate from a safe distance, hunting their targets through computer screens or virtual reality goggles. A handful of them, dressed in camouflage, stood up and saluted when one of their commanding officers brought me into their control room. Some looked to be in their teens. If they have experience with PlayStation, that's a big plus, the commander told me, because they already know how to use the controllers. I asked what other forms of experience good pilots tend to have. Gamers, basically, said the commander, who asked that his name and the name of the unit be withheld for security reasons. We get a lot of young dudes from the IT sector. For such recruits, the unit has been an attractive place to serve. Its fundraising efforts have allowed it to become practically autonomous, the commander told me. The base in Kiev has a dedicated personnel department to recruit new troops, its own training program to educate them, its own budget to pay their salaries. Down the hall from the cafeteria, we came across the office of the unit's in-house psychologist, who helps the men deal with trauma and post-traumatic stress. The psychologist told me his patients mostly seek help after trips to the front, where they experience the violence of the war up close. The pilots, by contrast, seldom show signs of psychological damage. It is more abstract to them, he says. It is not so close. This distance, both emotional and physical, has been among the advantages of waging the war with drones. In place of men, Ukraine has increasingly used machines to fend off Russian assaults, preserving the lives of its soldiers and civilians. A But the approach may also carry a cost, one hard to discern in the middle of a grinding conflict. We want our people to come back from the war as human beings, not as killing machines, says Gyunduz Mamadov, a former Ukrainian prosecutor who now leads war crimes investigations and serves as an advisor to the armed forces on the ethics of drone warfare. Some of these new systems make that more difficult because the war can start to feel less real. The next frontier in wartime technology, Mamadov says, will be artificial intelligence. The Brave One marketplace already offers a variety of ways to upgrade a drone with AI software, which can be used for targeting, navigation, and other functions. The newest models of the Vampire drone, which is produced by a Ukrainian company called Skyfall, allows pilots to switch on AI mode mid-flight, effectively handing over the controls to an algorithm. The drone's developer, who also requested anonymity, has not yet made fully autonomous targeting available to the units that buy the Vampire. We have the technology, he told me during a recent tour of the Skyfall factory, which has the capacity to produce around 4,000 Vampires per month. But I think we need to have a solid error prevention mechanism in place before we allowed a drone to make that decision about when to fire, he says. Who takes responsibility if the drone opens fire and ends up killing civilians? For Ukraine's drone units, such questions can seem academic. Some already have begun to experiment with AI-enabled targeting systems that can decide when to fire. Those drones can participate in the bonus program. A kill is a kill, Fedorov told me. As Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine nears its fourth anniversary, a few of Fedorov's allies have suggested expanding the bonus program in disturbing ways. One drone developer cited the technology from a sci-fi novel called Ender's Game, in which children are trained to unwittingly pilot swarms of drones in a space war. The young pilots are told they're only playing a game. Technically, something like that is already feasible, the developer told me. A drone pilot could sit anywhere in the world and operate their weapons at a distance, not knowing whether their screens are showing them a simulation of combat or an actual feed from the front. At this point, it is just a thought experiment, says the developer, but things could go in that direction. Fedorov wants to use the bonus program to drive innovation, especially in the field of air defense, which has been one of Ukraine's key vulnerabilities. In August, Russia launched more than 4,000 attack drones against Ukrainian targets, killing scores of civilians. The missiles used to shoot them down are effective, but they're often far more expensive than the drones themselves. In response, Fedorov raised the number of points awarded for shooting Russian drones out of the sky, and Ukrainian manufacturers have been developing cheap drones that can be used as interceptors. It's a new kind of air defense, says Fedorov. We are just creating the incentives to build it. For enough points, he says, the drone teams will find a way. Okay, that was War Games by Simon Schuster in Kyiv. A two-page photo spread here of Ukrainian soldiers carrying a Vampire drone after a training flight February 8, and the photograph is by Roman Chop or Chope. Well, there are two guys. One's dressed in camouflage from head to toe with kind of a helmet on. The other is dressed in a gray-green khaki kind of outfit, including shoes, pants, jacket. He's wearing a black or very dark gray knitted cap. He does not wear gloves. The guy in camouflage does. Well, let's see. I'm going to try and describe this drone, which they are holding. It kind of looks like a little space robot thing. It's black, and it's got four, maybe five rotors. Maybe six rotors. It looks like a miniature helicopter, if you remember what the old Bell helicopters looked like from the Korean era or from the MASH series. And these two men are able to hold it, so I don't know how much it weighs. They're standing on a level field of green grass, and the sky behind them is sky blue. On the inside of the article, there are two more photos, both very dark. One of them depicts Ukrainian soldiers flying a drone over Russian positions in 2024. It looks like a dark basement room with a fabric hanging on the two walls, which are shown in the photograph. Three men are watching a little tiny computer screen. It's smaller than my home computer screen at home, and it looks like the computer screen is fitted in a suitcase, so maybe that's also where the control board is, which is not easily identifiable, but I mean, it just looks like somebody's do-it-yourself basement setup. And then the final photograph here is a very nice portrait. It's an image of Fedorov in his office. He's wearing blue jeans, a black T-shirt. His hair is very dark, like black, and it's closely cropped and nicely trimmed around his face. He's seated on what looks like a blonde or oak desk. There's a chessboard on the desk. There's what looks like a manual typewriter on the desk. It might even be a lava lamp sitting next to it. I don't know if this is supposed to be some kind of a retro setup or if he really uses that antique typewriter, which may not really be an antique. The blue and gold Ukrainian flag is also standing in the photo. We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.